This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Europe starts relocation of refugees amid opposition. Fears grow in Afghanistan over Islamic State.
The local population is very scared, and they want the government to launch a full-scale military operation before they will either go back or have any kind of resistance against this group.
The U.S. space agency NASA looks for a few good men and women. 20-year-old songs become new again. We'll hear all about that. These stories and more coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. Europe is beginning the long, hard task of relocating the first refugees from Greece to other European Union states under its plan to tackle the migrant crisis. The EU wants hundreds of thousands of refugees to be resettled, but faces strong opposition from some members. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Athens Airport, the departure point for 30 Syrian and Iraqi refugees chosen to be among the first beneficiaries of the EU relocation plan. They were flown Wednesday to their new home in Luxembourg, avoiding the brutal journey by foot through the Balkans and Eastern Europe and bypassing the often prolonged application for asylum. En route, the refugees voiced their gratitude.
Luxembourg.
You happy?
Luxembourg, happy.
Very happy. Happy.
Among those bidding them farewell was EU Parliament President Martin Schulz.
When I saw the happiness and the lucky faces of the children, I thought this is exactly what we have to do.
Schulz called for all EU states to take part in the relocation plan, which envisages 160,000 refugees being shared across the European Union. But there has been opposition from several eastern member states, as Pavel Swidlicki of the policy group Open Europe explains.
It's not really for Martin Schulz to say what is fine and what is not fine, because it's really for national governments. And we saw that although there was a majority to agree to the relocation scheme, a number of governments protested and a number of governments voted very unwillingly.
On the Greek islands, thousands more migrants continue to arrive every day. A strike by ferry workers left many stranded at the dockside in Lesbos Wednesday. Swidlicki says the new plan will barely begin to tackle the wider problems.
With the 30 refugees taken from Greece to Luxembourg, this now takes us to a total of 116, so still many, many thousands off the target. And that's not even to mention the addressing the broader crisis.
Greece is at the front line of that crisis. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras issued a warning to EU partners.
Να μην ενθαρρύνουμε χερσαίες ή θαλάσσιες.
He said Europe should not encourage the out-of-control land or sea travel from Turkey to the rest of Europe that puts human lives at risk. For the vast majority of migrants, the journey to a new life in Europe is increasingly dangerous. Temperatures in the transit Balkan countries are falling fast. Aid agencies warn that thousands of lives will soon be at risk. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The Maldives declared a state of emergency Wednesday due to a threat to national security. In a post on its official Twitter account, the Indian Ocean Island Nation's foreign ministry said the measure would be in place for 30 days. The country's constitution allows the president to extend a state of emergency with the approval of the legislature. International Edition Sarah Williams spoke with M.D. Nalapat, professor of geopolitics at Manipal University in India, about the situation in the Maldives.
The problem is that it is definitely in a precarious state, but the reason for that is not external to the government, but very internal. The fact of the matter is that the current administration has, quite frankly, been steadily marginalizing those who are moderate, those who are secular, and has unfortunately been encouraging those who are more radical. So the problem is not external to the government, it's within the very heart of the government.
Now, on Monday, an explosive device was found and apparently safely diffused near the president's official residence. That followed in September. There was an explosion on the president's speedboat. President Yameen was not hurt, but apparently his wife and two other people were injured. And in addition, authorities have arrested Vice President Ahmed Adib. This just seems, again, that there, as you said, that there is great division within the government.
Well, the reality of the situation is that President Yameen basically is dealing with the family of the former president, Maimoun Abdul Gayoom, and who was running Maldives almost as a kind of a kingdom. And unfortunately, you know, his people are everywhere in the administration, and the current president is dealing with them. The problem is that the previous president has become very cozy with some groups in the Middle East who are, if I may say so, Wahhabi, and who have also got very deep pockets. So as a consequence, what's happening is that the very syncretic and tolerant culture of the Maldives is being infiltrated by religious teachers from outside and by schools being set up, which are anything but syncretic, which are in fact Wahhabi. And this is going on at full speed. And this is a source of great future danger to the Maldives.
Is there anything the international community can do to try to assist the country? I should note that U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy, I believe, has been, commenting about the human rights situation there. But in addition to him, are there other things that the international community, say the U.N., could try to do?
I think the international community has to wake up to this problem of Wahhabism and also acknowledge that, unfortunately, there are groups, Wahhabi groups in countries that are allied to democracies. We're talking about Saudi Arabia, we're talking about Kuwait, we're talking about the United Arab Emirates, and we're talking about Qatar, and we're also talking about Turkey. Now, many of these groups, unfortunately, there are groups there who are helping extremists out of a mistaken belief that these represent a correct religious culture. And as a consequence, what's happening is extremism is growing. So I think the democracies have got to be very clear that Wahhabism is unacceptable anywhere, and certainly in the Maldives. And the president has got to be told very, very clearly that democracy means taking people along. It doesn't mean arresting them. It doesn't mean identifying them as the sources of terror plots. There is no doubt that there is a danger to the life of the president. But that danger comes from forces that he has himself, frankly, coddled in the past. Now, ISIS, for example, has got a presence in the Maldives. There are individuals in the Maldives now who are recruiters for ISIS. So this is the situation that's taking place there. The president has got to understand that the only way he can deal with this is to ensure that the moderate elements who have been isolated by him, who have been completely, as a matter of fact, suppressed by him, they have to be brought back into the picture, and he has to run a collaborative government in the spirit of democracy. A small country cannot afford a situation like a big country where you've got a very sharp division between opposition and ruling party. A smaller country has got to take people along, and this is very important for the Maldives.
That's M.D. Nalapat, professor of geopolitics at Manipal University in India, speaking with International Edition's Sarah Williams. VOA journalists have ventured into Afghanistan's Nangarhar province, an area where the Islamic State is gaining ground. International Edition Susan Yaki spoke with South Asia correspondent Aisha Tanzim, now in Kabul, about what they found.
What we did was we went out all the way to a district of Nangarhar called Achin District, which has become literally the hub of Daesh or the Islamic State group in Afghanistan, especially in eastern Nangarhar. And what we found was that, A, they have been able to establish a safe haven there. There is an area where the local security forces do not go because it's too dangerous for them. And they're trying to galvanize the local population, but the local population is very scared, and they want the government to launch a full-scale military operation before they will either go back or have any kind of resistance against this group. So that was one finding. The other thing that we found was that these people who claim to be militants of the Islamic State group arrived in eastern Nangarhar first as they called themselves refugees, and they said that they were running away from the military operation that neighboring Pakistan is carrying out in North Waziristan. And initially they arrived with their families, with women and children and all of their belongings, and they asked local residents for shelter. And locals, because it's the local tribal tradition, they gave them a place in their homes, let them stay in their guest houses. And within a month or 2 months, as the number of these people, these foreigners, grew, they started displaying weapons and show of force, and eventually they pulled out the black flags and declared themselves to be the Daesh, the Khilafat-e-Khurasan, which is what the Islamic State group calls this region, which includes Pakistan, Afghanistan, and some Central Asian states. They also asked the locals to pledge allegiance to them, what they call Bayat or Baya. They also, what we also found, which was very interesting, was that they have money. They were offering locals up to $500 and $600 more for higher commanders as paid per month. That's a lot of money for Afghanistan. That's almost double than one what the National Army is paying their soldiers. So they have money. We are trying to track down the funding sources, but it seems like, and they're fighting with Taliban in the region. They have pushed Taliban out of like some districts, some areas. The Taliban are also fighting to regain control. So it's quite a mess here. That's what we found.
On a personal level, what about your own safety and that of your cameraman?
Well, we had to go through a lot of planning, days of planning, just to make this one trip. It was a very dangerous area. Even local journalists don't go there. We had to disguise ourselves as locals. I was in totally local clothing. I was wearing a long gown, what they call an abaya. I had that. I had another long gown that they wear, women wear, local women, when they're out. It's called a burqa. I had a security scanner on. We had to, inside Aachen, have security. So we had, for that part, got help from the army and the local district governor, and we were in armored Humvees because we were going over areas that very recently had seen IED explosions and cars had blown up. We had to be in a bulletproof vest when we went out to the front lines because sniper fire had taken out several soldiers on that check post. So that part, then we were constantly, we were passing through bazaars where drivers were saying that militants sometimes throw grenades at moving cars. You don't even have to stop there. So we had to think about all of those threats and mitigate. And then we were worried about somebody noticing us and following us back. So we were constantly looking in the rearview mirror to make sure, you know, nobody was following us. There was a lot of planning. It was very tense. I did not really breathe until we were out of Nangarhar and back on our way to Kabul.
VOA's South Asia correspondent Aisha Tanzim. Coming up, astronaut dreams. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A navigation device for your bicycle that attaches to the handlebars. It's called Smart Halo, and it's made by a company called Cycle Labs. It's a circular screen edged by a ring of LED lights. It connects to an app on your smartphone via Bluetooth. A right turn is indicated by a right side green semicircle. For a slight left turn, a green quarter circle appears at the top left, and U-turns light up a red semicircle on the bottom of the display. Here's Cycle Labs' Gabriel Albarol.
So we've made sure our device was simple yet smart. How? By reducing its interface to its simplest possible form, a circle. This luminous halo allows us to communicate an impressive amount of information.
Smart Halo is also a bike locator, a theft prevention device, and a fitness tracker. Its bright headlight turns on and off automatically on a battery charge that normally lasts 3 weeks. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosson.
This is VOA's International Edition. Being an astronaut used to be one of the most popular aspirations for youngsters in America. It seems there might be a comeback. Social media is saying something about it, and here is International Edition's G. Abby Lee to tell us more. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray. I have great news for anyone who wants to realize their childhood dream of becoming an astronaut. NASA will begin accepting applications in about a month, It's a U.S. government agency responsible for its civilian space program and aerospace research. NASA tweeted the news early Wednesday, and it's getting astronomical response from Twitter users.
Well, you'd figure nothing less than an astronomical response. Tell us about the tweet.
Sure. NASA is on Twitter at NASA, and it sent out several tweets Wednesday. One of them reads like this. Did you hear you can apply to #BeAnAstronaut starting on December 14th? Here are the details. And it shared the website link to detailed information. It's actively spreading the news on many social media outlets. For example, since 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, one of its astronauts, Christina Koch, began a Q&A session on Facebook. She's also on Twitter at @astro_Christina.
What kind of questions are people thinking about and asking?
Well, I'll give you an example. The second question on Facebook was, how old is generally too old? And Koch answered, there are no age restrictions. Astronaut candidates selected in the past have ranged between the ages of 26 and 46, with the average age being 34.
So before we get too many of our listeners excited, what does it all take?
Ray, you can find the information on its website, but to give you a short answer, there are three basic requirements. First, you need a bachelor's degree in a STEM field, which is an acronym for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Education. Second, you have to have at least 3 years of related professional experience. And third, you need to pass a physical.
Well, that's a whole lot of requirements, but I'm sure there's still a lot of interest. Mm-hmm. So just on Twitter, how big is the interest out there?
Well, in the last 24 hours, about 6,000 tweets use the hashtag #BeAnAstronaut. And that's quite a big interest. Ray?
Thanks, G. She tweets from our VOA International Edition Twitter account at @VOA_IE. And you can also follow her at @GabbyLee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Donald Trump is gathering huge crowds and sitting at or near the top of voter polls as he seeks the Republican Party nomination to run for president in 2016. Behind the campaign rhetoric, he is a candidate of billionaire businessman accomplishment. Just how well he might lead the United States could be based on his corporate experience. Nina Burley is a national politics correspondent for Newsweek, who's investigated Donald Trump's past casino business interests in Atlantic City, New Jersey. She spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about how Mr. Trump became involved.
Atlantic City made a bet in 1976 or 1978 after the people of New Jersey voted to legalize casino gambling that the more casinos, the better. And so Donald Trump came in the late 80s, early 90s, at the very beginning, and he did very well for a while. But what happened was other states in the Northeast Corridor realized pretty quickly that, wow, that is the way to make money, funding your roads and your education. So the casinos started to proliferate. So as Donald Trump came in there already with a large amount of debt, he had problems even before the competition from the other states, and he was filing bankruptcies, as he puts it strategically, as early as 1991. You know, he often says, I left Atlantic City before it cratered, or Atlantic City's a disaster. I got out of there with my money. And so we thought, well, let's go to Atlantic City and see what that means to the people of Atlantic City. And that's what I did.
And what did you find when you got there? What was the, quote, Trump effect?
Well, I mean, the first thing I want to say is Atlantic City is not a disaster. The boardwalk was lovely. The beach is lovely. And there are still a lot of thriving businesses. The first thing that I learned from numerous sources independently was that his business was notorious for not paying contracts in full. The unemployment of casino workers in Atlantic City is so drastic that the United States government had to pump in, I think, $25 million to do job training and to support these people. So leaves one with the impression that Donald Trump, for all of the good that he did for that city, which was he was a great impresario coming down from New York, bringing glitzy stars and world-class boxing matches and so on to this little beachfront community. For all of that, on balance, he did not leave Atlantic City better off than he found it. For somebody running for president, one might hold them to a certain standard that's higher than just the businessman who's taking the money and leaving.
Certainly through one's business career, there are going to be ups, there are going to be downs, there are going to be evolutions in the way that businesses are run. Do we have any indication that Donald Trump's other businesses were run in a similar manner to that you have seen in Atlantic City?
Well, you know, I didn't do a lot of research into his post-Atlantic City business career. There is a book that I referred to when I was working on this called Trump Nation by a journalistic colleague of mine. We don't work for the same company, but it's called, his name is Timothy O'Brien. The sense that I got from that, and I glossed the last part of the book, is that when he was back in New York, when he was out of Atlantic City, some of the more brash moves, perhaps, he learned from those things, and he wasn't doing that anymore. He still talks the talk that we are familiar with here in New York. He's brash, blustery. As far as the businesses, I think that he toned it down some after the Atlantic City years.
That's Nina Burley, national politics correspondent for Newsweek. Her article, Trump's Big Atlantic City Dump, is online at newsweek.com. Her music defined the sound of a generation in the mid-1990s. Now, Canadian-born singer and artist Alanis Morissette has reissued her groundbreaking CD called Jagged Little Pill. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, Jagged Little Pill, Collector's Edition, includes 10 unreleased songs from the same era.
And I'm here to remind you of the mess you left when you went away. It's not fair to deny me of the cross I bear that you did to me. You ought to know.
Alanis Morissette was only 19 years old when her third CD, Jagged Little Pill, exploded on the music scene in 1995. The Canadian-born singer-songwriter's first single, You Oughta Know, encapsulated many of the emotions she and other young women were feeling at the time. Morissette says that the song, which earned her the reputation of being an angry songwriter, was a reaction to a life of trying to please others, and then finally being able to express her true self.
Because You Oughta Know came out of the gate first, I think that was a label that stuck. And, you know, I'll take it. As a woman and as a feminist at the time and still now, if there were to be one horrifying label that's going to be stuck onto me, I'll take angry because it's so lovely. It's such a powerful force. Not the destructive version, but the one that inspires action. I'll take it.
It's like rain.
Morissette and co-writer Glenn Ballard came up with many of the songs in Ballard's studio in Encino, California. The two would write music together, and Morissette would write the lyrics. Now 41 years old, with a husband and a young son, Alanis Morissette says that time seems like just a few days ago.
It's definitely a different lifetime, though, for me. And yet there is this thread of continuity that's remained the same since when I was 2 years old, 19 years old. Now there's this sameness.
I'm high, but I'm grounded. I'm sane, but I'm overwhelmed. I'm lost, but I'm hopeful, baby.
Jagged Little Pill earned Morissette 4 Grammy Awards and has sold more than 33 million copies. Now the singer has her own monthly podcast called Conversations with Alanis Morissette. She says the podcast, which features conversations with authors, doctors, educators, scientists, and artists, is a natural outgrowth of her life. And what about music? Well, Alanis says she has a plan for a new album, but she wants to finish her book first.
I'm always writing songs, so I have about 15 new songs, and I had promised myself for a long time to finish this book that I'm writing, so it's holding the music hostage in the sweetest way. So I'll finish this book, I'm almost done, and then the second I'm done, I'll give myself probably 2 days off, and then I'll start writing again.
Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill, the collector's edition, is available now. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced this month that it is listing the military and great green macaws as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. Both bird species are endemic to Central and South America. The agency found that both species are in decline, primarily due to habitat loss, fragmentation and degradation, small population size, and poaching. Further, the existing regulatory mechanisms designed to protect these macaws are not adequate to prevent those threats from impacting them throughout their ranges. As a result, both macaws are at risk of extinction throughout their ranges. The military macaw inhabits tropical, semi-deciduous forests in Mexico and South America. Although it is a large distribution, its population, ranging from 6,000 to 13,000 adults, is highly fragmented into small, localized groups, ranging from a few pairs to approximately 100 individuals. The great green macaw occupies humid, tropical forests primarily in Central America and parts of northern South America. Its population, now ranging from 1,000 to 3,000 individuals, is in decline. The service recognizes the valuable, ongoing conservation efforts to protect these species by a number of private individuals, national and local governments, and non-governmental organizations, including the Wildlife Conservation Society and Fundación ProAves. These efforts include providing training to local communities to monitor populations and studying species via satellite transmitters to determine the species' home range and specific habitat. However, in spite of these notable contributions, great green and military macaw populations continue to decline. As a result of this listing, certain activities involving these two bird species will be prohibited without a permit, including import into and export out of the United States, take, defined by the Endangered Species Act as harm, harass, kill, or injure within the United States, and interstate and foreign commerce. By regulating these activities, the Endangered Species Act ensures that U.S. citizens and individuals subject to the jurisdiction of the United States do not contribute to the further decline of these species. The United States is actively engaged with conservation partners and the public in the search for improved and innovative ways to conserve and recover the imperiled military and the great green macaw and other threatened species.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.